All right, so welcome again to the creation science class. This evening we're going to pick it up and continue to just talk about the concept of homology, which basically just says that there are similar traits that can be seen throughout various organisms. And in evolutionary theory, homology is often used as a quote-unquote proof for evolution. Now, of course, we view it from a different perspective in that we view similarity being the evidence of a central or single designer. So what we're going to talk about tonight are some the problem homologous traits. And remember, homology is one of the probably most common sets of evidence that evolutionists will refer to. And one of the things that we rested or we summed up last week is that if we look at just specific examples, the evidence or the evidence looks overwhelming for evolution. Okay, if we focus in on, you know, a tree instead of the forest. But if we step back and we begin to look at the big picture and we look at all the available data from homology, it makes a really weak case for evolution. And this is one of the things we're going to talk about tonight. So let's go ahead and look at a few of these examples. As I mentioned, homology really seems to support the case for evolution. And it, at a first glance, it really appears to be a very strong argument. And as I mentioned, it's one of the most commonly used arguments for evolution. But really what the conclusion that they want us to draw from this is that similar structures and characteristics, features, functions, form, etc., between different organisms, different species even, indicates that the species had a similar ancestor. That's what we're supposed to derive from that. So from this assumption, organisms are commonly grouped according to supposed common ancestors into what's called phylogenies. Now, phylogenies are and they're presented in this branching tree structure we talked about last week. So keeping this in mind, let's look at some of the proof, or the true value of this proof. Interesting. I wonder why that went backwards. I wonder if my mouse is dying. That is weird. Huh. I've never had that happen before. Huh. That's weird. Okay, let's try this. There we go. We'll just go like that. All right. So, it's really strange. Went backwards. Where were we? Oh, yes. We were going to look at the true value of the proof that's offered as the evidence from homology. And we're going to look at the specifics that do not support, the specific examples of homology that do not support evolution. Michael Denton, I've referenced him before, but he said really quite succinctly just how valuable the proof from homology is. He says, common genealogy as an explanation for similarity has tended to grow ever more tenuous. Without the phenomenon of homology, the modification of similar structures to different ends, there would be little need for a theory of descent with modification. Like so much of the other circumstantial evidence for evolution, that drawn from homology is not convincing because it entails too many anomalies, too many counter instances, far too many phenomena which simply do not fit easily into the orthodox picture. The facts of comparative anatomy and the pattern of nature they reveal provide nothing like the overwhelming testimony to the Darwinian model of evolution that is often claimed. In the last analysis, the facts of comparative anatomy provide no evidence for evolution in the way conceived by Darwin. So Denton pointed it out pretty well. He said basically that even though homology or homologous structures is where Darwin started from, remember his finches, and all very similar, but they had different beaks. That was really a lot of the same kind of train of thought that he had in writing his book and in developing his theory. Denton basically says, you know what, none of that evidence really points to a common ancestor. None of it really provides the proof or the backing that evolutionary theory or supporters say that it does. In describing another problem with homologous structures in terms of genetic control and their value as proof for evolution, Gavin R. De Beer, he is formerly the professor of embryology in the University of London and the director of the British Museum, and the Natural History Section, and he's a devoted evolutionist, or was, showed that homologous structures need not be controlled by identical genes. And homology of phenotypes does not imply similarity of genotypes. Let me say this simply. Now, if the assumption would be that if the hand of the human being and the hand of the chimpanzee look very similar, which they of course do, then we should, in all other instances, essentially find the same code in the same segment of the genetic code to create the hand. That's not always the case. We often find the same structures being created by being codified in different sections of the genetic code that have seemingly no relationship to its location in others. And remember, in the genetic code, location is everything. Where it falls in the chain has a significant impact on what feature or what function is created from that information. So one of the things he points out is that, as he mentioned in the last part of that, the phenotypes do not imply similarity of genotypes. Basically, the similarities between critters don't mean that they have the same ancestors. That's essentially what he's saying. So a couple of other things here that before we get into some of the images here. One of the things that you'll see is that there's a lot of different statements like this from evolutionists. And in the evolutionary worldview, one of the things that's very common is to reject information that doesn't fit in with a model, or at least not talk about it. And that is really no different than you'll find in any other kind of ideology, really. And that's one of the things that, as a side note, one of the things I really appreciate about true Christianity is that we're not afraid of questions. We're not afraid to examine the evidence and let it speak for itself. This is one of the reasons why I appreciate creation science, because if we do look at the evidence, if we look at the information and allow it to speak for itself, it will, of course, expose the truth from us. So, with all these statements from evolutionists, we're going to look at a number of these anomalies, these counter instances, and these phenomena that do not fit into the evolutionary orthodoxy. So, there's a few examples here. You have the octopus eye, the pig heart, the Pekingese dog's face, milk of the donkey, the pronator quadris muscle of the Japanese salamander. They're all very, very similar and to analogous human structures. So a lot of similarities between these two. So do these similarities show evolutionary relationships? Well, the thing is that just because these things have some similar form and even some similar function does not prove that there's a similar a shared descendant. So let's look at a couple of examples here. Just as another example here, as you can see here, you've got the octopus eye and the human eye, very similar in a lot of ways. We talked about this last week, but the human heart and the heart of the pig are very, very similar. Very similar structures, and my understanding is they're veined very similarly. They actually function in much the same way, about the same size, about the same weight, about the same capacity, so on and so forth. But we can't exactly take a pig heart and put it into a human being and have the human being survive. We can take portions of it, and it's very small amounts of it, and you can get a valve replacement, but still not a one-for-one trade. And then we see on the top there a Pekingese dog skull. And the interesting thing about a Pekingese dog is that if you've ever seen a Pekingese, their eyes are more in front as opposed to a little bit less on the sides. Well, they're very similar, and if you were to take just the top half of the skull, they actually look very similar to a human infant, as far as the way that they're laid out and the size and so on and so forth. So does that mean that your children are dogs? Well, some people's kids act like dogs, but the reality is that just because they look the same does not necessarily mean that they have the same ancestor. And then, of course, the salamander there and the muscle in the wrist, and they have very similar functions. Well, again, these things do not point to an evolutionary ancestor. So, speaking specifically here, let's look at one example. The weight of the brain, in proportion to the body weight, is greater in the dwarf monkey of South America than in man. Okay? That little marmoset there, that's a human thumb. Look how little tiny that thing is. Okay? Which would make sense. You know, this brain weighs more than its... weighs more in relation to its body size. So, is that mean that this brain is more evolved than man because it's more of its body weight is taken up by its brain? Well, the thing is that this is one of those examples that evolution often points to, is that higher complexity in the brain will result in a more complex and more evolved creature. This is one of the things that you'll see when you talk about dinosaurs, and that they always talk about the dinosaurs having the brain the size of a walnut. And they use that information as evidence for its low status on the evolutionary scale, on the evolutionary ladder. Same thing with reptiles today. So it is not an example, therefore, of just because the brain's larger does not necessarily mean that it's more evolved or smarter, if you will. So a couple of other examples here. The plague bacterium, you can read it there if you'd like, it afflicts only man and rodent. So does this similarity show a close relationship? So between rats and human beings? Well, of course, because it affects both kinds, then we must be very closely related, right? Well, no, it's not the case at all. Love that picture. So, at any rate, in this case, the plague bacterium, because it does affect human beings and rats, doesn't mean that we're very close on the evolutionary scale, where homology should indicate that. If there's a similarity, and we use that to try to prove evolution, then what we're saying is that we should be closely related to the rat. Okay? So, a couple of other examples here. The plant nettle stings, they contain acetylcholine and the other one, hydroxytryptamine and histamine. These chemicals are also found in man. So are man and plant closely related? Well, no. Again, not the same. Although this guy, you never know. So, how about a couple of other examples? The root nodules of certain leguminous plants and the crustacean, the daphnia, contain hemoglobin, the blood pigment found in man. Are these organisms closely related to one another? Well, they don't exactly look the same. Although, I think this is where the term pea brain came from. Okay. All share some similarities, but some pretty important similarities, too. A couple of other examples here. With specific gravity tests, when they run on the blood of various animals, the frog and the snake and are found to be more similar to man than the monkey is to man. So here's the problem that we're running into, is that if homologous structures indicate similarities and a common ancestor, then these things should play out in all of the experiments that we do. So really, frog and reptile should be closer together than... they should be close together, and man and chimp should be close together, but that's not the case when we do tests in this environment. So again, we begin to see that the argument from homology is not as strong as they'd like you to think. It's not as concrete. A couple of other things here. So, if the concentration of red blood cells in animals is compared in millions per cubic millimeter of blood, man is actually more similar to frogs, fish, and birds than he is to sheep. So, I guess I'm bringing up all these examples because really, if we begin to really start breaking this down, the similarities fall apart very quickly, especially as we get to the functional aspect of those lives, or of those organisms, excuse me. So, remember, sheep are mammals, correct? Human beings are mammals, correct? Well, you know, you have fish and reptiles. Not mammals, of course, and fish and amphibians, excuse me. Again, not reptiles and birds. Wait a minute, we should have some closer similarities between the mammals than we do the others, but that's not the case. So, a couple of other things here, a couple of other examples. The bones are often used to show relationships. Remember that diagram I showed you last week on what's called pendactyl limbs? It's when you have five digits And it can be five visible digits, or it can also be, for instance, in flippers, you don't see five digits within the flippers, you see them in the bones instead, but pendactyl limbs. So bones are often used to show these relationships, bone chemistry should also be useful in this regard. So if the calcium-phosphorus ratio is plotted against bone carbonate, man proves to be close to the turtle and the elephant. Okay? The monkey, close to the goose, and the dog to the horse, but distant from the cat. So we go all over the place. Okay? So, again, this isn't as concrete as they'd like you to think. Okay? So, there's a chemical ring that's found in plant chlorophyll, in hemoglobin, and other animal respiratory pigments. It's sporadically as a coloring pigment in molluscan shells. One that's very common is called the Powa shell. Make a lot of jewelry out of it. It's very common in the South Pacific, but it has a very specific color. It's also in feathers of some bird species. So how does this chemical similarity speak for the relationships? Because they're all over the place. They're between invertebrates and vertebrates and plants and animals. And yet this similarity is supposed to, if according to homology, should show a similar and very close ancestor. But it's not, in fact, the case. Consider reptilian scales, bird feathers, and fur. The evolutionist holds that feathers and fur have evolved divergently from scales. So the problem, though, is that some of the I missed a slide here, apparently. I have another slide there. It's supposed to be there. Anyway, let me go back here real quickly. So the problem, though, is that these different skin coverings, they really can't be called homologous. It's not as if you're going to find fur and feathers and scales all on the same critter, at least not without a certain amount of Hollywood magic. You of course hear all the time that T-Rex's relative or distant relative down the road is the chicken, but that's based upon specific homologous structures, but ignores the vast number of differences in those traits. So, of course, according to some of the things that we've looked at, well, we should be we're more closely related to sheep than we are, say, to chimpanzees, if we're looking only at specific homologous structures. And obviously, that's not the case. Okay? So the problem with things like this, when you run into very, very different functions and very different structural complexities, there's a lot of differences between scales, feathers, and fur. For instance, we know that the feather is entirely feather-like. The first feathers we've been able to find evidence of, guess what they look like? Feathers. There's no in-between structures. There's no scales with feather tendrils on them or feather fibers on them. We don't find it. When we find feathers, we know what they are because they're feathers. Okay? The same thing can be said for when we find reptile skin. When we find imprints of reptile skin or we find actual dinosaur eggs with soft tissue in them. Oh, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. We'll talk about that later. But when we find dinosaur tissue, and if it's scale tissue, it looks like scales, okay? Or it looks like reptilian anyway. And of course, fur, same thing. The genes that code for each type of skin covering must contain a sequence or a subroutine for keratin, because each of these is primarily a form of keratin. Scales, feathers, and fur are essentially keratin. Yet this subroutine could well be integrated into quite a different overall set of genes. So, how could we explain the origin of, for instance, feathers from scales if we're not even finding the routine for keratin in the same genes in different critters? It doesn't make sense. Again, remember, location is everything for genetic code. So we're not finding those things. And by the way, you probably know this already, but keratin is what your fingernails are essentially made out of in your hair as well. So, all right. So the entire genome, this is an interesting one, of the tiny nematode C. It's a little tiny worm. See it right there? The one on the left is the worm. It has recently been sequenced. This is the first complete genome of a multicellular organism to be sequenced, or it was. It contains about 100 million base pairs. That's a lot. And about 20,000 genes. The problem for evolutionists is that some of the genes of C. elegans, that's the name of this worm, are so similar to those for humans that scientists have substituted the human genes for the nematode genes, and the human genes have worked just fine. So of the 5,000 best known human genes, 75% of them have matches in the worm. So if homology proves a common ancestor, does man have more in common with the worm than with other animals? Well, according to strict homologous approach, yes. Because, like I said, 75% of the human genome has a match in that tiny little worm. These worms are very small. You'll find them in your garden. They're actually really good for your garden and for your flowers and whatnot. But according to homologous structures, we have more in common with them than we do with mammals, for instance, other mammals. So, while there are some obvious similarities between species that might lead one to think of a common ancestor in evolution, there are a great deal more similarities that simply do not support a common ancestor. It just isn't there. While there are certainly similarities that we can see, I mean, they're obvious, and you can understand where that perspective comes from, that chimpanzees and humans have a similar ancestor. You can see it if you just look at the homologous structures. But there are so many more similarities that do not indicate a common ancestor that we just can't allow homology to be the answer for evolution or to be the evidence to support it. Instead, what we really need to be able to do is to step back and talk about these dissimilarities, the things that should be. We should be able to find similarities between organisms, but we find them between the wrong organisms. We find them between man and octopus instead of man and horse. Or we find them between a fish and a human being, or a worm and a human being, instead of between where we're supposed to be finding them according to homologous structure traits. Yes?
So just to clarify my thing here,
yeah, in a lot of ways you can say that. Absolutely. It started with an examination of the exterior structure. I mean, you look at where Darwin started. He started looking at the things he could see. Now, keep in mind, Darwin never even had a microscope. He couldn't see the structure of the cell. He just thought they were globs of protoplasm. He had no idea of the complexity of the cell, much less the understanding of the genetic code. So you look at outside structures, and yeah, it's easy to group organisms together. But when you really start, you can't use that as the only way of separating and organizing critters until when you start looking at really specific things, or in more specificity, not even just specific lines of code. But I'm having all kinds of fun tonight. But if you start looking at all the things that are available there and all the things that homology should be able to prove, it doesn't work that way. So you're right. They started out with looking at external structures, but the more science has learned, the more it points away from common ancestors and to a designer, or at least a grove, if you will, of creation as opposed to one tree. Okay? All right. So from here, we'll go ahead and look at a couple of the other things here just as a reminder. There's a lot of different things, a lot of similarities between critters that really only point to a designer. And I think one of the most interesting pieces of information in that regard is the fact that the same subroutines can be found throughout the different locations within genetic systems within different organisms. So where keratin is produced, as an example, is is found in different sections of reptiles and mammals and birds. It's found in different sections of the chromosomes altogether, of the gene structure altogether. So, again, just because that they look similar on the outside does not mean that they have a similar or the same ancestor. So, with that, we'll go ahead and continue here. We'll talk about genes and chromosomes a little bit today. This is one of the... We're going to get even deeper into this discussion. This is an interesting piece if you think about it, because the advancements in technology have allowed us to be able to see so much more than we really ever could before. This next section focuses on the molecular perspective specifically regarding genes and chromosomes. So when we did these, and the advances in technology are continuing. The amount of information that we're able to see in the human body and in the individual cell and the human genome has been codified, if you will. It has been spelled out. So the entire human gene is pretty interesting, actually. Has all been mapped out and described. It's interesting, the guy that, I cannot remember his name off the top of my head, but the man whose genome was mapped was an atheist. And after a very long, I believe it was a 15-year project, he wrote a book called The Language of God. And it dealt with the infinitesimal complexity and design inherent within the human gene. And he's a believer. At least he's a believer and a designer. So pretty interesting if you look at it from that perspective. So we understand so much more about it. And so, of course, because of all the technology, and this seems to happen every time there's a new technological advancement in medicine, it's always about evolutionists have always grabbed onto it and used it as a fuel for their hope. So it's renewed so that they can say, hey, we now have evidence to prove. Well, wait a minute, though. DNA is fundamentally the very information upon which our entire life cycle is built. Everything in the world, every living thing is based on genes and chromosomes. So as we shall see, molecular biology does not actually provide the proof that the evolutionists want. This section is based heavily on a few books, but one of them that we'll talk about a lot, it's written by Michael Behe, called Darwin's Black Box. And he's a molecular biologist, very smart man, and he pointed out some really hard things for the evolutionists to understand or to accept. And, of course, therefore he was shunned in the scientific community because he didn't agree with them. But we'll be going through quite a bit of his information. So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about what DNA is. So let's talk about some of the basics here. DNA is the fundamental blueprint of life. It is found in every cell in your body that has a nucleus. So if your blood cells do not have nuclei, so you do not have DNA in your blood. It is a fundamental blueprint. It is responsible for the controlling of every function in your body, of every cell in the body. Everything that happens within your body in every cell is controlled by DNA. Let's take a little bit closer look here at what DNA is and where it resides. Here's a typical wall of tissue cells. Of course, it's an illustration. As you kind of drill down through some of this, you'll see that there's one cell, of course, from that tissue, and then inside the cell, we see the nucleus. Now, instructions that provide all of this information reside in the nucleus. They're necessary for every living organism to grow and to live. All this information resides in the nucleus of every cell. Now, these instructions tell the cell what role it will play in your body. So it'll tell it when it's recreated, what it does, what it transports, how it works, who it listens to, how it interacts, what it's supposed to do, etc., etc. And if these instructions get scrambled, then your body starts to react in very strange and deadly ways. You'll get things like tumor growth. Cancer is an excellent example of basically cells not understanding what they're supposed to be doing, and they replicate too quickly. So the instructions are very specific and very precise. So if we go inside the nucleus, we see the 46 chromosomes present in every cell with a nucleus in the human. So there's 46 chromosomes in the human. So you can drill down a little bit further. The instructions come in the form of a molecule called DNA. DNA encodes a detailed set of plans, like a blueprint, for building different parts of the cell. So you look at this and you can see there are several different components to the genetic structure. There are four primary amino acid combinations of amino acids, but there are four common components. They're called adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. They all connect with each other. Specifically, A with adenine, with thymine, cytosine with guanine, specifically. Those are the only way that they can group together. They also then have a sugar phosphate backbone. So how does it store this information? Well, oh, by the way, DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. You want to be able to spell that one in Scrabble. So how does it store the information? Of course, the information, as I mentioned, is it is stored, or the molecule comes in the form of a twisted ladder shape. Scientists call it a double helix. The ladder's rung are built on the four-letter DNA alphabet of A, C, T, and G. These alphabet pieces join together according to special rules. A always pairs with T, C always pairs with G. And so the question becomes, how can only four letters tell the cell what to do? Well, it's not as if there's not more complexity to this. This is, in and of itself, is pretty amazing to just have four letters in an alphabet that can explain your existence, or at least your physical existence. But it's more, even more complex than this. So within the cell, these letters combine together to make words. The words make sentences. These sentences are called genes. Genes tell the cell to make other molecules called proteins. Proteins enable a cell to perform special functions, such as working with other groups of cells to make hearing possible, for instance. So the next question you might have, well, is what is a gene? Well, genes are instruction manuals for our bodies. They are the directions for building all the proteins that make our bodies function. Genes are made of DNA. One strand of our DNA contains many genes. All of these genes are needed to give instructions for how to make and operate all parts of our bodies. Genes are small snippets or sections of DNA. Okay? So genes contain instructions for building proteins, which are involved in all sorts of things. Hemoglobin protein is just one example. Hemoglobin, of course, is, we've talked about this before when we looked at sickle cell anemia. Hemoglobin is a major component in blood, of course. It carries oxygen. But hemoglobin is one example. Other proteins, such as the enzymes that produce pigment in your eyes and in your skin and so on and so forth, keratin in your hair and your fingernails, et cetera, they're all produced by genes. Everything that you are is produced by a gene. So then, what's a chromosome? Well, a chromosome is, again, another component of DNA, but each cell in our body contains a lot of DNA. In fact, if you pulled the DNA from a single human cell and stretched it out, it would be 3 meters long. It's about as long as a car. 3 meters long. So a meter is about 3 feet. Okay. So 3 times 3 is 9. That's about, what's that? That's a good question. I can explain it, but not right at this point. But 9 feet long. That's a tremendous amount of information in every one of your cells. Okay? Yeah, the size of the cell is obviously slightly larger than that, but not 9 feet. So here's the thing, is that how does that information get, how do you contain all that information within such a compact structure? Well, it's because it's in a twisted format called a chromosome. So the packaging of DNA into a chromosome is done in several steps. It starts with a double helix of DNA, and then the DNA is wrapped around some proteins. A very simplified example is if you take two or three strands of the same thickness of rope and you tie all three of them to a tree or something, and then at the other end you start twisting the rope and you twist them together, eventually that rope is going to get tighter and tighter and tighter, and then as you keep twisting it, it's going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. You can do that with your shoelaces, or rubber bands are another good example. Is the more you twist it, the more the less space it seems to take up. So the DNA is wrapped around some proteins, which is interesting, that the material necessary to code the cell, which is a protein, or at least to carry it, is generated by the gene. So which came first? The one to hold the structure, or the information to create the item to hold the structure, to create itself? So the answer is yes. Okay? So each human cell has 46 chromosomes. Okay? So what happens with these this DNA is that it's done in several steps. As I mentioned, it's wrapped around some proteins. And these proteins are packed tightly together until they form a chromosome. And then chromosomes are efficient storage units for DNA. So how many chromosomes does each cell hold? Well, human beings hold 46, but if you're a fish or a fly or a horse or whatever, you're going to have different numbers of chromosomes. All DNA is organized into two sets of 23 chromosomes. We get genetic material from both of our parents. That's why children look like both their mom and their dad. Okay? Because you'll at different times. That's right. Yes, Elizabeth.
So that 1 9-5-foot strand, is that all the DNA it needs to make everything in you?
Yep.
So then you have 46 pairs of that in one cell.
It's the entire length. So
that makes the one chromosome, but you have 46.
You have the entire, that's your entire length of DNA. That's every bit of coding in your, yeah. Yep, so if you're going to combine all of them and stretch them out. Yep, no worries. So, again, as human beings, we get half from each set of parents. So if you look at the set of chromosomes, you can see that there's matching chromosomes have been lined up in pairs here. Hello. There we go. Conversion to Windows 10. Gotta love it. Anyway, so as you can see, there are matching chromosomes that have been lined up in pairs, one each from mom and dad. Although the DNA double helix is too small to see, chromosomes can be viewed with a microscope, as you can see in this picture. So you can see the matching halves from mom and dad. Pretty interesting if you think about it. I realize it's not a real straightforward or not an adequate explanation, but I kind of look at it like taking 23 cards from a blue deck and 23 cards from a red deck and shuffling them together. And that's how you end up with human beings. You know, you shuffle some DNA together and, you know, voila, you have all the different traits that you'll see within human beings. So there are two sex chromosomes that determine whether you are male or female. In this picture, the sex of the chromosomes are labeled X and Y. The set of chromosomes in this picture are from a male. And you can tell because females do not have a Y chromosome. Instead, they have two X chromosomes. So women have a little bit more information, I guess. That's where all the words went, apparently. Anyway, so thanks to the Genetic Science Learning Center at the University of Utah for the illustrations. It's pretty interesting, actually. If you ever want to look into some of that, it's really amazing what they're able to do, and the information they're able to pull out of the individual cell is really pretty remarkable. So here's a prediction. Now, an important component of any theory is the ability to generate predictions from the theory and then test them. That's how you know that your theory is accurate. Okay? It's basic. Remember the scientific method. You're always testing. You're always testing until you can prove it. And one of the aspects or one of the components to testing is generating a theory based upon your results, based upon your theory. So, this process of testing a theory helps provide valuable information to bolster or weaken the theory's premise, to help prove or disprove specific points of it, and then we can move on from there. We can add, make changes to our theories, etc., etc. So if as evolution demands, there has been a gradual change of all creatures from simple to more complex than the evolutionary scheme would predict the increase in chromosome counts and quality as one moves up the evolutionary scale. Okay, so in other words, according to evolution, the more complex an organism, the more chromosomes it should have, right? More information. Does that make sense? Okay. So, however, what we find in this regard does not support such a prediction. And thus, it presents a serious problem for evolutionists. For instance, here's a chart. It compares the actual chromosome numbers of several organisms with the evolutionary prediction. So, on the bottom there, you can see the prediction, of course, on the left-hand side, gives you a more simple at the bottom to more complex at the top. So, crayfish, ferns, reptiles, herring, bat, dog, and man, simple to more complex. But if we look at the chromosome counts, well, what we notice is that the fern has 512 chromosomes, and human beings have 46. Crayfish have 200. The dog has 78. That's why I like some dogs better than humans. No, just kidding. That's why the bat has 32. The least of all of them. At least, but yet, with bats, they can communicate with sonar. Which is pretty wild. Echolocation, of course. I mean, there's certainly things that they can do that we can't. They can fly. Okay? So this doesn't work. It doesn't match up. So the chromosome count doesn't fit into the results predicted by the evolutionary model. So in response to the facts from chromosome counts, evolutionist Ashley Montague was forced to conclude and admit that the number of chromosomes does not appear to be associated with the degree of complexity of an organism. Wow. And he probably went to school for 12 years to be able to figure that out. Obviously, you look at that chart and 512 chromosomes in a fern? Who knew they were that complex? Why aren't they ruling the world? You know? Yeah, that's right. It's because they missed the opposable thumb. That's right. If ferns had opposable thumbs, we'd all be in trouble. So, let's talk a little bit about the genetic similarities between humans and chimps. This is a very, to illustrate the difficulties with predicting chromosome counts and then therefore correlating it to similarities, let's examine the genetic similarities between humans and chimps. So, as I mentioned, if some of the predictions are that, or some of the calculations are that humans and chimpanzees share 95 to 98% of the same genetic code. Well, if that's the case, then the manner in which they store DNA would also be similar. Okay? Yet what we find is that they are not, or that it is not. So a logical prediction from the statement that organisms that share a common ancestor is that they would possess the same number of chromosomes as well. Which again, we find they do not. So when we look at chromosome counts, humans have 46, as I mentioned. Chimpanzees have 48. So what we're saying, according to evolutionary theory, humans are more evolved than chimpanzees, according to evolutionary theory, and they lost information to become more evolved. Beginning to punch some holes in the evolutionary theory. So the smallest changes, of course, will significantly affect the organism. There's only really a difference of one pair of chromosomes in this case. This relatively small difference may seem trivial, but remember, chromosomes contain genes, which they themselves are composed of DNA spirals, and as the blueprints for every program and process in the body, even the most minute changes can have significant effects on the body. Pretty significant. Remember, we looked at mutations, and those simple changes in the DNA structure or in the gene had significant impacts on the organisms, usually resulting in death. So, how can evolution then explain the loss of two chromosomes to make the organism more complex? That does not make sense. It flies in the face of evolutionary theory. So, If we were to assume that this change occurred as the result of evolution, we would have to assume that the original DNA did not do its job correctly or efficiently, and therefore those two extra genes, or chromosomes, excuse me, were dropped off and then generated a more evolved human being. Well, however, losing chromosomes does not make sense physiologically, and it would probably prove deadly for the newly created species. Because remember, it's not as if chromosomes 1 and 2 only control a very specific function. As in, let's just pretend that for a moment, the chromosomes 1 and 2 only had something to do with hair color. Well, if you pull those out, then it doesn't matter, right? But that's not the way that it works. All the function of the genetic code is dispersed between all the chromosomes. That's one of the reasons, again, why when we when human beings procreate, why half of the genetic code from the parent, from each set of parents, why it intermingles and creates such interesting people. Okay? Because they're not just specific areas of information that are stored in each chromosome. All right, so this prediction, continuing to talk about this a little bit more, is that the facts do not support the original prediction. So our prediction was that we would have higher levels of complexity with more information. But the facts do not, in fact, support that. No one has done a more outstanding job of providing the evidence for this statement than evolutionist Michael Denton. Evolutionists suggest that as one ascends the tree of life, organisms should become increasingly separated by differences in biochemistry from the earliest and the most primitive organisms. But in fact, no evolutionary trend can be observed in the biochemical data. We cannot see any kind of a trend of more complexity or a trend of any sort in the biochemical data. There is no gradation from one group to another. There isn't anything that would show any kind of evolutionary sequence. Denton's conclusion was that at a molecular level, there is no trace of the evolutionary transition from fish to amphibian to reptile to mammal. There's no trace of it. None. This was published in 1985, by the way. So, no trace at the molecular level. I mentioned Michael Behe. He wrote the book Darwin's Black Box. He did an amazing job of destroying the theory of evolution from a molecular level, from a biochemical level. There is no evidence for it at all. So in other words, evolution is really just spin. That's all it really is. With highly technical jargon aimed at making an evolutionist appear more intelligent than those who do not subscribe to the theory. So Michael Denton says, at a molecular level, no organism is ancestral compared with its relatives. Yet in the face of this extraordinary discovery, the biological community seems content to offer explanations which are no more than apologetic tautologies. Basically, fun little stories. That's what tautologies means, essentially. So, from out of the mouth of an evolutionist, he's saying, faced with this evidence, instead of accepting the facts and letting the evidence speak for itself, we're going to just come up with fun little stories to explain away these problems and these differences and these challenges to their theory. So, evolution is just spin. Okay? So, we'll stop there tonight. Next week, we will begin speaking about comparative embryology. And as the name implies, embryology is the study of the embryo. And this is one of the biggest, well, at least up until it was discovered, probably one of the biggest lies ever told in the study of genetic, or in the study of evolution. A guy by the name of Ernest Haeckel propagated probably one of the biggest lies ever in regards to evolutionary theory. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the timeline there, because it's pretty important considering that Ernest Haeckel was called one of Darwin's bulldogs. And yet, I learned about his stuff when I was in high school in 1990. Ernest Haeckel died long before I was born. So why was I still learning his stuff as facts in high school? Good question. All right. We'll talk about that next week. Thanks for your time.